I want real solutions, not just campaign promises.
There's so much media bias and misinformation. I can't keep things straight.
I don't know who to trust. What am I supposed to do? Take my neighbor's word for it?
Why is it always the other guy's fault? What about accountability?
I'm split on issues, stuck between parties. What do I do now?
Did you know independent voters are America's largest voting bloc?
Yeah, but they totally feel politically homeless. Like, the two-party system just ignores them.
Independent voters, you're overlooked no more. This is our time to shine and stand together. You're listening to Independent Times.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York on this, the first broadcast of network television's first daily half-hour news program.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News, and that's the way it is, Friday, March 6, 1981.
It's not the best of times, nor the worst, but these are undoubtedly independent times. Welcome to Independent Times, the podcast for politically homeless independent voters navigating our polarized world. I'm your host, Lisa Singer, and I'm so grateful you could join us today. We are consuming more media today than ever before in history. Yet we are more polarized and feel less informed than ever. Remember when the news felt different? When figures like Walter Cronkite were the most trusted in America? Today, it's an endless cycle of partisan outrage, and it's easy to feel like you just want to tune it all out. Well, you're not alone. A 2025 YouGov poll shows just 29% of independents trust the media. And for independent voters, that's not just a number. It's a serious problem, leaving us to ask, if I can't trust the news, how am I supposed to feel safe, much less be expected to vote? Today, we'll dive into the critical moments that took the press from a unifying force to a polarizing one. We'll lay out the story of what went wrong, not to dwell on the past, but because you can't fix a problem you don't understand. More importantly, we'll share practical tools to help you navigate the news with confidence and healthy skepticism. We're joined today by my co-hosts, award-winning journalist, host, and producer of Fox 24 News Now, Leila Gulen, and Emmy Award-winning television news host, Brian Gallo. Welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. Independents are caught in the crossfire, trying to find truth in what seems like a sea of spin, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And according to a Gallup poll, trust has crashed from 72% in 1976 to, get this, 31% in 2024. This didn't happen overnight.
Agreed. It didn't happen overnight. And we're going to get into all of that. But I think we can agree that despite the mistakes, the free press has had an incredible successful run that shaped our democracy for the better. So here's a quick reminder of some of those proudest moments that made the press the indispensable fourth estate.
Mike Devers, in his book, said that I had a short attention span. Well, I was going to reply to that, but oh, what the hell, let's move on to something else. President institutionally seeks to wield power to accomplish his goals for the people. The press complicates the wielding of that power by using its own great power, and that makes for friction. Every president will try to use the press to his best advantage and to avoid those situations that aren't to his advantage. To do otherwise results in a diminution of his leadership powers. The press is not a weak sister that needs bracing. It has more freedom, more influence than ever in our history.
One of the things that we all keep in mind in this business all the time is that our job description is in the Constitution of the United States, in the First Amendment. Why is it there? Because the founding fathers understood how important a free press is, not for its own sake, but for the sake of the citizens of the United States, that an informed democracy is what you need to make a democracy survive. We are the public's intelligence service. We're there at your local city hall. We're there on Capitol Hill. We're covering business issues and health issues and science issues, all of which matter vitally to how you live your life. The founding fathers were very wise in understanding this, that you need those tools, you need that information to be an informed citizen, a participant in this great democracy that we all value so much.
In a totalitarian society, there is only one source of news. In a democracy, you have a second source, and that is the version that is produced by a free press. A citizen can then check the government version against the version he gets from the press and decide which one that he or she wants to believe. If there were no other reason for having a free press, that alone would be reason enough.
That clip from Bob Schieffer nails it. He said, a free press is our vital second source to check the government's narrative and hold them accountable. Forget weather, forget sports, forget traffic updates. We're talking about keeping our government from running wild. The First Amendment was written by James Madison back in 1791, and it was a truly radical idea to think that a free press would be an essential check on power. Genius, absolutely genius.
Right. And that independent spirit, no pun intended, has carried on for what, 249 years? Fast forward to 1971, and the Pentagon Papers were a game changer. Daniel Ellsberg leaked classified documents showing U.S. leaders had misled the public about the Vietnam War for decades. The New York Times began publishing, but the Nixon administration sued, citing national security. The Washington Post jumped in and also started publishing the Pentagon Papers, which fueled anti-war sentiment by exposing government deception about the Vietnam War, contributing to public pressure for U.S. withdrawal. That was a proud day for journalists.
Of course, one of the greatest lessons from the Pentagon Papers is the vital importance of a strong and independent press. But with only 16% of Americans subscribing to a newspaper today, our support for the Fourth Estate is more critical than ever. Also, to our listeners and anybody who wants to see this story unfold on the big screen, check out the 2017 film called The Post. It stars Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, and it offers a gripping look at the Washington Post's courageous choice to publish the papers in 1971. But for a firsthand account, you can also watch a 1997 interview where Chris Wallace sat down with then-publisher Katharine Graham, and she describes the heart-pounding choice to risk everything to publish the truth. Here's a short clip.
Had several moments of crisis in your career. You had the Pentagon Papers when you were decided to publish against a very real threat of a court order. You had the obviously the running battle with the Nixon White House during Watergate. And in both cases, you were betting the future of the Washington Post. Again, what is it like? How alone do you feel? What gets you through it?
Chris, thank you for asking that question. I have stressed many times that Watergate was really never a decision because I was backing the editors and we went into it gradually and we were alone, I must say, for months. And I did back the editors, but I believed in them. And so there was really no choice. It started very small and it grew. In the Pentagon Papers had been given by Daniel Ellsberg to the New York Times, and the New York Times had published them after thinking about it for 3 months. And then they had been enjoined by the administration and taken to court and stopped on the theory that the government could use prior restraint against a newspaper. And so they had been stopped. And in the meantime, just as they were stopped, the Pentagon Papers were delivered to us. And the editors and the reporters convinced me that momentum and the idea that you couldn't enjoin the press you couldn't stop the press in advance of publication was very important and that they had to print that night. I said to Fritz Beebe at the other house, what would you do? Because I got along with him wonderfully. I loved his judgment. And he said, I guess I would not. Because I can understand that. We were going public. It was very risky. And the administration was threatening us. And so I really gulped. And I really was not what your heroic leader is. I just said, oh, go ahead.
However, as inspiring as that moment was, and it was, with the press standing up to the power no matter the cost, it also highlights that there's this constant tension between the White House and the media. And we see it today. It's no different. We see the constant clashes between the Trump administration doing things like blocking the Associated Press reporters from the Oval Office, from the press briefing room, or the long list of lawsuits against major networks for critical reporting. And the presidential pushback has ramped up lately. There's no doubt about that. But it's happening at the absolute worst time possible, when trust in the news has plummeted from 72% to 31%, as Layla just shared at the beginning of the episode. So it really begs the question, what shifted from Watergate's triumphs to this? Did journalists just drop the ball, or is there something bigger eroding that trust? And this is huge for our democracy and for independent voters who have a much more difficult time following the news because they have to sift through so much spin just to make informed votes. So, Brian, whatever happened to unbiased gold standards like Walter Cronkite, who was the most trusted man in America?
Well, the most significant blow to fair and balanced reporting was the ending of the Fairness Doctrine. Reagan and his supporters at the Federal Communications Commission argued that the doctrine was a form of censorship. Okay. So I think it was 1987, the FCC voted to repeal it. Reagan then vetoed a bill from Congress that would have made the doctrine a permanent law, officially just killing it. This action, in effect, cleared the way for the partisan media landscape we know today.
Let's look at the key moments when the Fairness Doctrine died and the door swung wide open for opinion-driven cable news and talk radio.
What on earth is wrong with a Fairness Doctrine that requires them, if they slant the news, to let someone tell the other side of the story?
In the 1980s, the FCC began to feel pressure from broadcasters who felt the Fairness Doctrine was infringing on their First Amendment rights, that they were being forced to say things that they did not want to say.
One of the problems with our democracy was the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. And I'd like you to explain what that is.
When radio was invented, Congress passed a law to make sure there was a diversity of voices. And, you know, ultimately, the Fairness Doctrine said you could only own a limited number of radio stations because they didn't want one corporate conglomerate to be able to control the narrative. You could only own certain ones in certain jurisdictions. You couldn't own a newspaper and a radio station in the same jurisdiction. They wanted to make sure that there was a diversity of voices in our democracy. They could not tell a lie. If they told one side of the story, if there were two sides, you had to let the other people tell their side of the story. That was the Fairness Doctrine. Reagan abolished the Fairness Doctrine. And then you saw this huge consolidation, so that today, I think there's five companies, maybe now only four, that control virtually all the radio stations, all the television stations in our country, almost all the newspapers, who are now telling American what's news.
So 1960, there were only two talk stations in the United States. Two. All right. By 1995, there were 1,200. Once talk radio started, the Fairness Doctrine went out the window. So Rush Limbaugh, for example, he began in the early 90s. By 94, he had 20 million Americans tuning in to hear a conservative point of view. There was no balance. It was Mr. Limbaugh's show, and for 3 hours, he espoused conservative tenets. And the government didn't bother him. But the government had a problem. It had to abolish the Fairness Doctrine because of the rise of talk radio.
And so you have a complete erosion of accountability around the facts.
Because prior to that, the media platforms had to actually give both sides of the story. And then once that was dropped, they lost the accountability. They could say whatever they want to say.
You know, there's more to the story, as we say in the newspaper business. The birth of cable news and the 24-hour news cycle was born with CNN's 1991 Gulf War coverage. The O.J. Simpson trial, as we all recall, that was covered day and night for months and months and months. So news changed from informing the public to entertaining the public at that point.
Well, you know, the bigger story, not that those aren't important, but the bigger story is the big mistakes the media made. And like everything else in life, right, people remember the things you did wrong rather than the things you did right. You know what I mean?
Totally. Benjamin Franklin once famously said, "It takes many good deeds to build a good reputation and only one bad one to lose it." Sorry, continue.
No, you're good and you're right. That's exactly right. But honestly, the media can't afford to make mistakes. Let me drive this home with a key recent example. So just bear with me real quick. I'll try to wrap this up. The 9/11 attacks hit on September 11, 2001. We all remember that, right? And less than a month later, on October 7th, 2001, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to take out Al-Qaeda. The group behind hijacking four planes on that horrible, terrifying, deadly day. But President Bush also wanted to invade Iraq, and the White House pushed hard to claim their leader, Saddam Hussein, had weapons of mass destruction, like chemical, biological, and even nuclear. But it was a hard case for Bush to make, since Iraq was not directly involved in the 9/11 terrorist attack. Then around like 2001, 2002, the New York Times, mostly from their reporter Judith Miller, ran stories amplifying these unverified claims of WMDs, relying on anonymous sources like Iraqi defectors who later proved unreliable. They didn't dig deep enough, and neither did much of the mainstream media. Some outlets raised doubts about Iraq possessing weapons of mass destruction, but the drumbeat for war was loud. And then, in October of 2002, the Senate voted to authorize the war when no WMDs were found in Iraq. The Times admitted its mistakes, but the damage was already done. It sparked, what, a 20-year war, massive instability in the Middle East, and a huge blow to trust in the media. Independents, and quite frankly, all Americans felt betrayed, wondering why the press didn't push harder for the truth.
Here's Judith Miller years later, interviewed by Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, reflecting on those front page stories and what went wrong.
I believe that you helped the administration take us to like the most devastating mistake in foreign policy that we've made in like 100 years. But you seem lovely. The information came from the Bush administration, yes?
Broadly speaking, yes. John, were we not supposed to report what it was that had the community, the intelligence community, so nervous about Saddam?
No, you should have reported it, though, in the context that this administration was very clearly pushing a narrative. And by losing sight of that context, by not reporting...
I think we did. The story said we did.
I wholeheartedly disagree with you.
Well, that's what makes journalism. I mean...
It's actually not what makes journalism. All right. Well, we're never going to see eye to eye on it. I mean... I appreciate you coming on the program. These discussions always make me incredibly sad because I feel like they point to institutional failure at the highest levels, and no one will take responsibility for it.
I think they point
to... They pass the buck to every individual other than themselves.
I think they point to intelligence failures that I still worry about every day, because we're still relying on the same intelligence communities to give us information about Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, and the other countries that we have to deal with.
Well, hopefully, given the same effort, we'll get to invade all of them soon.
Hope we won't.
Yeah, true. Let me just add a couple more media failures that hit the country hard. So in 2008, the financial crisis blindsided millions of Americans because most news outlets missed the signs of the housing bubble's instability. So while a few reporters had raised some red flags, the mainstream media didn't dig into the subprime mortgage risks. This left the public completely shocked. Completely on the back foot when the market crashed, costing millions of their homes, and not by their own fault, by the way.
But little by little, these mistakes made by the media make it hard for Americans, and especially independent voters, to trust the media. And it often feels like even the legacy media outlets are pushing a narrative instead of just reporting the facts, which I always just understood that was their role. Margaret Sullivan, in her book, Newsroom Confidential, she really nails this issue. It's a fabulous read. And Brian, you also told me that you read Newsroom Confidential. Remind us, what does she say about narratives taking over?
Well, Margaret Sullivan, a little bit of backstory, who was the public editor at the New York Times, argues that journalism has shifted toward what she calls defensive performative neutrality. This is where outlets go to great lengths to appear balanced, even if it means equating facts with fiction, right? She gives examples like, some say the earth is round, others insist it's flat. Or more relevantly, some say climate change is real and caused by human behavior. Others insist it doesn't exist at all. This practice of false balance gives equal weight to both sides. Does that make sense?
It does. And I love how there are flat earth believers and support groups around the world. but there's more of a real world implication for both sidesing a news story.
No, you're right. I mean, Margaret Sullivan's critique of the New York Times 2016 election coverage is the prime example. On one hand, the paper ran 10 front page stories about Hillary Clinton's emails in just like, 6 days. But on the other hand, the paper ran the same number of front page stories, 10 total, on all the policy issues combined in the 2 months leading up to the election. So this gave readers a completely skewed perspective, prioritizing one single issue over all of the others. Sullivan believes it influenced the outcome of the 2016 election.
Here's just a quick taste of how relentless that email coverage actually was from Margaret Sullivan herself.
I left the Times in the spring of 2016, but I was there for the beginning of the Hillary Clinton email thing that that the Times gave so much attention to. They broke the story about, you know, her use of the of a personal email server and all that sort of thing. I was struck by the odd relationship between the New York Times and the way they covered Hillary early on, before she even was a candidate. It was like they kind of decided in advance that she was not only going to be a candidate, but that she indeed would be the president of the United States. And they covered her that way, you know, with like just huge amounts of coverage. Like, we know you are indeed going to be the president, so we want to be very, very, very tough on you. And so I think that coverage was very skewed. And I think, you know, it did have an effect. The Times is so influential.
Yeah. Well, and to highlight the Clinton email story is a perfect example for independents of how skewed coverage feels like a narrative. You know, it's being pushed on you, and it fuels the feeling that the media is playing politics instead of just reporting the facts to hold power accountable. As they said in the TV show Dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. Only the facts. One great of my show. Favorite shows. I love that show.
Great show.
I think it was also in The Naked Gun, but they stole it from Dragnet.
Just the facts, if you don't mind, ma'am.
Great show. So let's stay on this point of the lack of trust in the news. Brian, any other big stories from the past 10 years where the media got it wrong, hitting independents' faith in journalism?
Oh, wow. Okay, top of mind for me is Bob Woodward's 2020 book, Rage. He had tapes of Trump admitting in February that COVID was deadly, but held the story until September, which was like raising questions about prioritizing book sales over public health. And the biggest recent story is Fox News. We all know it, amplifying false 2020 election claims, which cost them $787 million in 2023. That lawsuit was from Dominion Voting Systems. We all remember that.
Here's a look at how Fox anchors learned just how expensive those lies became.
Well, now to a major settlement in the lawsuit accusing Fox News of airing lies related to the 2020 election. Fox and Dominion Voting Systems agreed on a settlement of more than $787 million to avoid a trial. Scott McFarlane was at the courthouse when the deal was announced.
This was the ultimate last-minute settlement. The jury was seated. Opening statements were about to begin when both sides blinked and agreed to an eye-popping dollar figure.
Avoiding a trial that would have turned Fox News' biggest stars into star witnesses, the company will cut a $787.5 million check to Dominion Voting Systems.
The president's lawyers alleging a company called Dominion.
Fox was accused of knowingly airing conspiracy theories and baseless claims falsely linking Dominion to a scheme to flip votes during the 2020 election.
So much for those claims that voter fraud never happens. Of course it happens. They knew it happened.
That's despite evidence, including internal messages in which Fox executive Suzanne Scott warned challenging Trump's bogus claims could hurt ratings.
Dominion still has a defamation lawsuit pending in this same courthouse in front of the same judge against Newsmax for claims made after the 2020 election. And Fox still has a defamation suit against it from voting machine company Smartmatic.
Yeah, I remember that really well. You know, when these kinds of mistakes happen, the retractions are often small, but the impact is certainly quite massive.
The impact of the media mistakes is no doubt massive. And I would argue it's because we're accustomed to politicians lying to us, but we are definitely not accustomed to the press doing the same, or even worse, falling down on the job, so to speak. And in each instance of a government cover-up, and especially the ones that drag on for years, like the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal or the Iran-Contra affair, or more recently, the question of how involved Russia was in interfering in the 2016 election, we do have to ask ourselves, where was the Fourth Estate? And I know this conversation is only the tip of the iceberg, but just from a top-level perspective, how do these mistakes keep happening? And I'm sorry to put this all on you, Layla, but you've worked as a professional journalist for many years, so I'm curious, what do you think?
Well, you know, I can only offer you a technical answer to your question. You know, these failures, they violate the code of ethics, which journalists must adhere to. It's almost like taking the Hippocratic Oath. Many belong to the Society of Professional Journalists, and their code of ethics requires that journalists do seek the truth, that they minimize harm in the process of seeking the truth, and that they also act independently, meaning that one side or the other isn't, you know, influencing you. So this means that journalists cannot accept bribes. They can't anything like that, or you know, publish a story or push a narrative. But as a professional journalist, it's really painful for me to discuss these failures and the erosion of trust in the news. I hear it all the time, even from friends, you know, and it shouldn't happen. The safeguards, they're in place. They're in place for a reason.
Still, today, anyone with a laptop or a cell phone can post anything they want to social media, which is only making matters worse. Brian, is that a fair statement?
To some degree, yes. I mean, we all know social media has essentially gutted journalism's business model. I mean, platforms like Facebook and Google take over 50% of digital ad revenue, and it starves newsrooms. Algorithms push sensationalism like fake COVID cures, right? Election fraud claims go viral. News consumption dropped from like 51% in 2016 to 38% in 2022 as people just tuned out. Independents face conflicting takes, right? Retreating to echo chambers or just like giving up.
Yeah, giving up for sure. Social media is totally killing local news. It really, truly is. The 2024 Mettel report says that 3,200 plus newspapers. Just imagine, over 3,000 newspapers vanished in America since 2005. And this is right around the time that I graduated from J school. 130 closed last year. So that leaves 206 counties and 55 million Americans in news deserts where there is no local newspaper, not even a weekly. So the scariest statistic, I think, is the 1 to 2 newspapers in America go out of business each and every week, and we can't have that. That's just horrible.
That is frightening. Well, our founding fathers knew that the only way to keep a democracy is to have a well-informed citizenry. So this has become a real crisis in our country, and there are only 16% of Americans who subscribe to the news in either digital or print form. It's really kind of amazing to think about it, that any newspaper can stay in business. So with all that depressing news? Is there any hope? What's the fix, Layla?
Yeah, let's see. What is the silver lining here? All I can say is subscribe. Subscribe to credible outlets. Support your local newspapers and subscribe to at least one national paper, either in print or digital form. I mean, digital is totally fine. It's totally respectable. So subscribing, it's a civic act that I really feel we must all perform.
Brian, your fix to address the lack of trust in the news?
Well, like Layla said, I mean, everyone in America should subscribe to at least one media outlet, even if it's like a dollar a week. Anything to help journalism succeed, right? We need them to keep us informed on what? Like weather, sports, local events in our communities. And yes, of course, but hold our elective officials accountable. I mean, what do you think, Lisa?
Well, like many of our listeners, I grew up in a home where the kitchen radio was constantly tuned into the news. Both local newspapers were delivered daily to the house. And I've been subscribing to a national newspaper since I was 18 years old. So as I go through social media and I read it, I can spot fake news, at least enough to check and do some more research when something looks off or suspicious. So for our listeners, I would say go to Ad Fontes Media and check the sources that you're reading now for their bias leaning to ensure that you're getting a diverse set of perspectives for your existing subscriptions. Other places to cross-check stories are ProPublica, Reuters, AP, and this incredible website called Ground, which shows you the headline stories from left, center, and right, so you can see how a story is covered from all angles in the polarized media, and you can see it all in one place. I'm not describing it well, but the website is incredible. Please go to Ground. It's incredible. But my best advice is that independents can lead by diversifying their sources of information.
Okay, Lisa, I adore you, but there you go again. I mean, like, honestly, most of us don't have time to just cross-check news. We just want to consume the news, not turn it into homework assignments each day. You know what I mean? I mean, I say that with love.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that. And I hear you loud and clear. But sadly, that's where we are at in America today. And with so much misinformation, so much disinformation, and foreign influence, we really have no choice but to devote a little bit more time to news analysis on our own. But luckily, it doesn't have to be overwhelming. So here's a montage I put together of a few simple news literacy habits that I hope can help our listeners.
So what's your take?
We need better media literacy in this country.
100% agree. I feel like people have lost their minds.
With like everything that is at stake and everything that is happening in this country, I need people to be more aware of where they're getting their information and what exactly they're exposing
Bro,
themselves
to. Bro, tell that to my mom.
But listen, my problem is this. Like, if you're retweeting or resharing or reposting an account that has more than two digits in the handle, that is a code red.
That's a bad actor.
Absolutely. Don't trust that.
But here's the problem. We got one side being like, that's fake news. We got the other side being like, that's fake news. And then we got a bunch of people on the internet just doing whatever they want, saying Donald Trump's daughter is converted to Islam. How the hell are we supposed to figure it out?
At the end of the day, you got to be able to trust some of the sources, but you have to do your own diligence in the information that you're consuming. You go into a supermarket in this country and you've got like 20 different types of zero calorie water, and everyone's like reading the back of the labels and what's syrup and what's not, what's going in it, what's not. You got to do the same for news. Look at the people. Do they have a track record of putting out decent information?
Staying informed didn't used to be this hard, but with the rise of social media and the proliferation of biased news, it can be hard to understand even the basic facts of the story. So it's no wonder that trust in the media is currently at an all-time low. Instead, let's read the story on Ground News, a website and app developed by a former NASA engineer on a mission to give readers an easier way to be well-informed without the chaos. As a news comparison platform, we gather articles from every source reporting on any given story, so you can compare coverage and see which angles get emphasized or ignored. Helping you see every side of every story. Our goal at Ground News is to fight the bias that's all too present in our collective news diets. Not by telling you what to think, but by empowering you with the context and clarity that allows you to think for yourself.
AdFontes Data Platform. It's an interactive visualization on which we plot thousands of news sources that we've rated. So we've got a reliability axis, and from top to bottom, generally above 40 in our system is highly reliable. This is fact reporting, analysis, investigative reporting, the things that journalists do. And we do it with a fairly large sample. Currently to date, over 53,000 articles and episodes manually rated, which forms the basis for what we believe is the largest training data set for machine learning in the world.
Thank you, Brian and Layla.
Of course, keep digging for that truth, Lisa.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lisa. And I always say, question everything. Mm-hmm.
We started this episode asking how we can find clarity in a world of partisan spin. And while we went on a journey through some of the biggest mistakes in media history, we also found the answers. The tools for navigating this world are in our hands. It's about recognizing the narratives, diversifying our sources, and yes, investing in a free and independent press. And that brings us to our independent hero of the week, Alan Miller, founder of the News Literacy Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit, empowering students to spot fact from fiction in today's info chaos. For independents battling biased spin, his work reminds us news savvy starts young. You can learn more about them at newslit.org. Here's Alan in his own words.
In 2006, I was invited to speak to 175 sixth graders, and that was where this idea all began. The field of news literacy did not exist. We had to tell people what news literacy was and why it mattered. NLP today is the leading provider of news literacy education in the U.S., if not globally. Teaching news literacy is not an option. It's an essential survival skill in an information age. We launched our classroom program on February 2, 2009. It was really striking how engaged those students were right out of the gate. So we started a new field and a new movement, and we started to build some momentum. And then the 2016 election happened.
Your social media feed may have been part of Russia's interference in the election.
The election has cast a light on misinformation online.
Critics saying those viral hoaxes could have really influenced the election.
Suddenly, fake news and alternative facts and filter bubbles were very much on people's minds.
If we don't give them the ability to navigate today's information landscape, they're at a significant civic disadvantage.
And it really felt like, you know, we went from being kind of a voice in the wilderness to an answer to a prayer.
What a fantastic discussion today. Thank you, Brian and Layla, and a big thanks to our listeners at home for joining our community at Independent Times, where politically homeless voters like you find clarity in a polarized world. You're not alone in this journey. Next time, we'll tackle another big issue, why trust in government is at historic lows. You won't want to miss it. Until then, please follow, like, subscribe, share, and keep charting your own path.